Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by AOL Music and Spinner.com, where you can get free MP3s, exclusive interviews, and more.
This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 216 for October 12th, 2009. It's pimpin' time.
This Week in Tech is brought to you by Audible.com. Sign up for the Platinum Plan and get two free books. Go to audible.com/twit2 and follow Audible on Twitter. User ID audible_com. And by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off your new account, go to squarespace.com/twit. And by GoToMyPC, the safe way to access your PC remotely that's as secure as online banking. For your free 30-day trial, visit GoToMyPC.com/twit.
This is TWiT, This Week in Tech. I am Molly Wood, filling in for Leo Laporte, who is in Dubai at the TEDx conference. And I was just saying that as much as I am thrilled and honored to be hosting TWiT this week, I frankly would kind of rather be in Dubai, looking at the fabulous buildings.
Still, except there's a problem with you being in Dubai.
There is, yeah. They don't want me there. Anyway, I'm very excited about today. I'm here in the TWiT Cottage. I'm joined by Brian Brushwood, the host of Scam School.
Howdy.
On Revision 3.
How are you, Captain Kirk?
Right here in the... Yeah, I'm wearing Captain Kirk orange today.
Because you're the leader. You're in charge. You're running the show.
It was an accident, but I feel good about it.
I'm wearing a red shirt, which all of a sudden I'm regretting.
I was
going to
say, dude, take the red shirt off quickly.
I wasn't going to mention it, but yep, he's going down. Also, joining us on Skype, Gina Trapani, host, co-host of This Week in Google, so you already know her, TWiT fans. And everyone is so excited. Hi, Gina, say hi.
Greetings, humans. Hello.
This is what happened when we all heard that Gina was going to be on the show. Patrick Norton, Colleen, who's totally in charge of the board and the switching and everything today, and everybody else was basically like, oh, Gina?
It's rock star time.
Yeah, so no pressure.
No pressure.
And you even have the Madonna microphone going on.
I do. I got the little Invisimic thanks to Colleen. I'm feeling very chic.
Very fabulous. And TWiT regular, because we need somebody to keep us in line around here, Patrick Norton.
I don't think I'll be able to succeed keeping this crew in line. I'll just try to keep from getting run over.
Not remotely. Like, if he was here in studio, he'd have power, but he's too far away.
It's true. He is far away. He can't do anything. And also, we could probably ask Colleen to turn him off.
I'm we'll just see how saying, that goes over.
Look out. All right, well then, let's get this train rolling. So it seems that the big story of the week and the weekend that just keeps getting hotter and hotter is that evidently T-Mobile has lost all of the data.
Whoopsie.
Of its sidekick users. Dun, dun, dun. Or as Engadget puts it, one of the biggest disasters in the history of cloud computing and certainly the largest blow to Danger and the sidekick platform.
Is it looking like it's confirmed, like it's definitely gone? No,
go ahead.
I was say the last email I saw was apparently they were doing a SAN upgrade, fairly standard SAN upgrade, that they didn't do a backup before the SAN upgrade and things went really, really sideways. Yeah. And that they think they've pretty much lost everything that you didn't have backed up locally, which on your phone. So anything that's still on your phone, you can probably put it back up on their servers again, assuming you haven't pitched your phone at the wall in disgust and completely melted.
They're encouraging people to like not reboot their phone. Don't turn your phone off. See if you can make something happen.
Yeah.
And that is so ridiculous. So you just have to plug in your phone and hope that things are, you know, going to come back or that you can back up your phone to your computer.
Basically. And that is essentially what they said to people. Like, we're really sorry, but your data has, quote, almost certainly been lost.
Wow.
Can you imagine?
Can you imagine being the guy who has to write that email? Like, how do you sit down and start typing that one out?
Yeah. You know, I feel bad for that guy, but not nearly as bad as I feel for everybody in level one tech support who's dealing with people going berserk on the phone right now because their pictures of their grandkids are gone. Oh. Like the guy who screwed up the backup's probably getting fired or beaten with a stick or whatever they do to people who have an oopsie of that magnitude.
Yeah.
But I really feel bad for everybody that's basically, you know, hello, this is T-Mobile. My name is, you know, Nwanda. Can I help you? And then going through that whole process of, we lost your stuff. I'm really, really sorry. And then getting screamed at and then having to, you know, do whatever comes next.
So can you imagine, when is the last time that you ever called tech support? I mean, at least they usually pretend that they can give you an answer, even though they almost certainly can't. Like, to call tech support and to basically, you know, and you know every call is like, and then have them go, yeah, you're out of luck.
We got really sorry about that.
Make sure you don't power down, kids.
Now, I tell you, I've never been happier to have an iPhone than right now, because before the iPhone, I never would have backed up the contacts and stuff on my phone number because it's such a hassle. It's such a huge pain in the butt. But because it's integral to getting your updates on podcasts and all this and your calendar and your other synchronization, finally, I have a backup for all my numbers. I would have been one of those people screwed if I had a sidekick.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I actually think that most smartphone owners who are not, like you said, iPhone owners, who are connecting to iTunes all the time for various reasons, usually 80 meg upgrades, is that I don't think smartphone users do back up their data. I know they do
if they've had a phone stolen.
The what?
They do if they've had a phone stolen.
Well, good point. They should if they've had anything else stolen and they're still not.
But that's the tough thing. It's easy to say, oh, you should, ouch, you should, you should. But I'm saying realistically, never would have plugged it in, never would have backed it up. Would have been one of those people saying, golly gee darn.
Right.
Only I don't think I would have used those words.
The chat room is pointing out, by the way, if you have a sidekick, that the reason they don't want you to power it off is that, like a Palm, the data is stored in RAM. So that if it is powered off or if the battery runs out, then all that data is gone. As if it's not gone already. That is definitely, though, that is a huge cloud problem.
Now, how many people, like, obviously none of us, I'm saying obviously, but does anyone here have a sidekick? That seems like kind of a non-techie kind of guy phone to have. Like, you don't have a sidekick, do you?
No.
It's a second-class smartphone or something.
Well, that's the other thing. It is kind of, right? It's not an actual smartphone as the weird definitions go. It's a messaging phone. So it's definitely even less likely to be backed up. But what is everybody using? I'm on a BlackBerry now because I broke up with my iPhone.
Yeah, it's got to be the iPhone.
Gina, what do you have?
I have an Android phone, G1.
Yep. Not surprised. Patrick?
I was planning on breaking up with my iPhone. Then my hardware got repaired and AT&T went to 850 megahertz in San Francisco and it saved our relationship.
It won you back.
They actually, 850 megahertz made the iPhone functional. Because it basically it stopped working in my house.
Does it work in the office now? Because I know none of the iPhones seem to work at Revision 3 headquarters.
It depends on whether I'm in my cubicle, which is like dead center in the Faraday cage. It's a little awkward. You know, if it's on the right side of my cube, I get 4 bars. And if it's on the left side of my cube, it gets a bar. But I can actually stand up and use my cell phone in the office for the first time ever.
That's pretty good.
They can't roll out 850 megahertz nationwide on AT&T fast enough for me.
I broke up with my iPhone and then a week later got an email from AT&T saying that they'd put up a new 3G tower a mile from my house, which sounds like it should have been a wah-wah kind of moment. But then my friends came over with their iPhone 3GS. Still didn't work.
No kidding.
Yep.
Yeah.
Talk about living in a Faraday cage.
So you're screwed no matter what. Sorry, sidekick. Sorry, iPhone.
No matter what you do.
Actually, summer. Gina, are you happy with your Android phone? Since we're talking about,
I love Android. I don't love the handset. And I would love to upgrade to a new handset. The G1 is kind of crappy, but Android is fantastic, and I do love it. And I'm actually wondering if syncing to Google, that doesn't really count as a local backup, does it? But I don't know. I feel like Google's probably not going to lose all of my account data anytime soon. Like, this is just a ridiculous. I mean, how do you not have a backup, even if it's, you know, a day old backup? I don't understand that.
Yeah, I agree. It is. I mean, most importantly, it is totally unacceptable to have a cloud service like that and have that level of failure. And apparently there's already a class action suit brewing.
Like anything will ever happen to the cloud again after this. This is a one-time deal.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to be fine forever.
It's going to be fine after that.
there's one really good thing about this is that everybody who has anything stored in this manner, or anybody who's doing cloud computing right now on a really serious basis is now freaking out to make sure that they've done due diligence and have, you know, better backup systems in place. At least I hope.
Hopefully.
You know, exactly. As I stare at like Gmail and Google Docs and Dropbox and.
Well, I tell you what, it's at least it's just a one-off isolated thing. It's not like there's another story that's similar to this of somebody whose data is in the cloud and all of a sudden they can't access it. Like, no, that would never happen twice in the same week.
No, never. There's no way that if you were, for example, a fan of Google Voice, you just couldn't make calls in certain areas. Like,
well, maybe that, but certainly Facebook would be fine, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like,
Facebook
there's no chance
fine.
That.
No.
Oh, wait.
Wow, are there just like a bunch of different stories like this today? Yeah, we'll get to the Facebook thing in a minute. Although first, I want to talk a little bit about Google Voice because this is pretty germane to our kind of mobile device discussion. The FCC now says after AT&T accused Google of violating net neutrality laws by refusing to provide calls to rural areas.
For free,
even though they're not a phone service. And we, I believe on my show, characterize that as bald-faced lies. From AT&T. Nevertheless, the FCC has decided to investigate whether Google has, in fact, violated telecommunications laws by refusing to connect some calls to rural areas.
By the way, I cracked the code on this one because you notice at the very end of the article, it says they asked how the service works and how Google sees the service fits under the FCC's regulatory schemes. It also asked the company to explain its invitation-only policy for the trial service. I think they're upset because they did not get Google Wave invites. I think that's what this is all about.
That seems like the most likely possibility. Now, Gina, I feel confident that you have probably talked about this issue and exactly how Google Voice works. Is the FCC just misunderstanding the way that Google Voice works, or do you think this is a legitimate kind of thing to look into?
I think that the FCC does kind of misunderstand. I mean, I think Google Voice is kind of a new product, and I think that it's important to understand that Google Voice is really kind of a complement to your existing phone service. Like, you can't make Google Voice calls without a phone to begin with. It is not a phone service, just a sole phone service. It's in addition to that. I mean, it gives you number portability and it gives you voicemail transcription, but you still need a phone to use it, and they are providing it for free. So I think Google's argument is valid. And I think it's so funny that they title, you know, like Google's official blog posts are always like very kind of politically correct. But this one was like sex, call centers and, you know, Google Voice. And they're making the argument that some of these rural areas that are really expensive to route calls to have like sex call centers in them to pump traffic into them. So I thought that was kind of an interesting point. That they brought up. But I think that Google has a good point. And it'd be really interesting to see. I mean, this is totally one of these new technologies. They're sort of breaking new ground, and the FCC's got to figure out, well, are we going to treat these types of things differently?
Yeah, I think it's reasonable in that sense for the FCC to at least look into it and say, well, okay, there's no question that this is new technology. And even if it's not strictly speaking a phone service, is there a reason to check this out? And then, I mean, I guess you do have to wonder, like, is it okay for Google Voice to say, we're just not going to provide service to those areas if they want to play in the telecommunications space? And I think what got AT&T so frustrated is that they were thinking, well, you're playing in our sandbox, but you don't have to follow the same rules. Yeah. Although one could argue, should you have to follow the same rules if you're not actually a phone service, which I guess I just keep coming back to.
So did I hear right? Did you say that the app only works on the phone? There's no way to use the same service from your desktop PC?
Well, I mean, from your desktop PC, you can initiate a call through Google Voice, through your Google Voice number, but it calls your phone.
Right.
Okay, so you can't receive incoming calls that way. Gotcha.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And I mean, cell phones, I don't know if this is comparable, but cell phones can't make 911 calls, right? Or from certain voice over IP. I mean, there are restrictions with different types of phones that there are, right? I mean,
at this point, most of the voice over IP should be, sorry, all of a sudden the Blue Angels are like roaring over the building. If I start looking up and like hiding under a desk, you'll know why. But most of the voice over IP systems now have 911 call routing, the major ones. And that's kind of been the classic fight between traditional telecommunications and everything coming out of like Silicon Valley or technology or whatever it is all the people like AT&T's looking around like, we have to comply by all these rules. We have to do all these things. And, oh yeah, Google, you call us out anytime you feel annoyed by anything we do. So I think there may be just a little bit of tit for tat going on here to try to make it feel more competitive for AT&T or maybe less annoying, because they have to be looking at Google and being like, what? are you guys doing?
Oh, and I'm sure just, it drives them crazy.
Scared to death that they can't tie people to a single number for, you know, a 2-year contract.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that they're saying, look, here's this thing that has a really good chance of taking away business from us, and yet they don't have to follow the same rules that we do, and they basically get to keep going around acting like big old jerks who everybody loves. You know, I mean, I think they're just like, oh, we hate you, Google.
Yeah.
Do they think it'll really take away business? Or because it seems like it's going to be a complement to any existing phone line, whether it's a landline or a cell line. Or are you thinking like people are just going to hop from account to account as soon as they have like a relatively guaranteed number through Google Voice?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's what Gina said, is that people are going to be less, they're going to be, you know, if this technology becomes widespread, let's start there, right? Because right now it is very tiny. It's a very tiny number of people who are using it. But if it becomes widespread, it's absolutely the kind of thing that could make people significantly less interested in signing those long contracts with a given carrier. They're going to be a lot more interested in buying unlocked phones, paying for a small, you know, a much smaller and cheaper plan, and then using something like Google Voice with, like, or using a Verizon MiFi and an iPod Touch, you know, and Vonage or something. I mean, I think it makes the whole sort of cell phone hegemony slightly less necessary.
That's true.
But yeah, so let's, moving on to the cloud, let's get back to the cloud thing. Now that we've got that boring Google Voice out of the way.
Minor story.
Brushwood was totally trying to skip that. He's like, I don't want to talk about it.
It was related. It went forward. No, it was a segue.
It is. You could go back. Really, it was a good segue. I agree. I blew it.
It got slapped down.
Anyway, so people are reporting. So last week, about 7 or 8 days ago, there were all these outages on Facebook. I saw one. It said that the accounts were down for maintenance. And then apparently now reports are still rolling in like crazy that people cannot access their accounts. No word on whether those accounts are actually gone for good. But
don't know if it's a sidekick problem yet.
But people are still shut out. I haven't seen super widespread reports, but it does sound like the inaccessibility continues.
I'm not one of those guys that's totally like sucked into the Facebook vortex, but I know people who are that way, and I would imagine it would just explode their brains with frustration trying to deal with that.
Yeah, I can't imagine. Facebook outages, I mean, forget Twitter outages, right? A serious Facebook outage, that is Ragnarok right there. Not funny. Apocalypse.
Took me a second to remember what Ragnarok was. Like, is that a band?
Disaster. It should be. If it's not, Ragnarok is a great band name. Speaking of, you know, sites with outages, Twitter is apparently, this was so sad for Twitter, because there were reports that Twitter was having talks with Microsoft and Google on All Things D about big data mining deals. And then right in the middle of that last week, Twitter outage.
Oh, did they?
I think.
God, I'm sensing a theme in all these stories.
I know.
The internet. The cloud is not your friend. Why does this feel like 1995 all over again?
Yeah, and the Twitter outage was particularly creepy, right? Because it wasn't like Twitter's down, fail whale. It's like you can only see your own updates and no one else is saying anything. Like you're alone in Twitter. Like it was really scary.
And I think it happened for all of us, whereas at that awkward moment where we made a joke, we're like, right, guys? Right?
Right. Crickets.
Guys,
is this thing on?
You know what's funny is I didn't even know there was a Twitter outage, but I had that moment. The moment you described it, I'm like, that's why nobody thought I was funny that day.
I know. I had it too, and I didn't know. And then it was like a day later that I read there was an outage, and I was like, oh, phew.
You know, to go back to the Facebook thing, like really briefly, I think this is the thing that scares me about cloud computing the most. It's not that like we're going to have some giant server outage and everyone's data is going to be gone. I mean, that's a possibility. My greatest fear is that one day somebody's going to try and brute force my Gmail login, and Google's going to decide that to make my account inaccessible. It's a free service and I can't contact them and they won't let me back in. Right. So like, just my account will be down. So, you know, the whole internet won't be up in arms. I'll just be screwed, you know, and, you know, if I wasn't doing This Week in Google, no one would know about it. You know what I mean? I think I think the account lockout is a thing that I'm a little more concerned about.
It's absolutely true. It's more the sort of the secret police threat than the, you know, the actual apocalypse kind of thing.
Well, so I always like laugh about a certain ex eBay person who wants to be the governor of the state of California. I'm like, you're the person who's single-handedly responsible for the worst customer service I've ever received in my life. You locked down $1,400 of my cash in a PayPal account because of something you refused to explain and couldn't explain unless I faxed in a copy of my driver's license and my social security number to a random number. Like, and I'm sitting there and I'm like, you know what I mean? Like, you're like, and people are like, you know, and you sit there and I completely understand where Gina's coming from, where it's just like looking at that, like, yeah, everything, if everything's gone, it's really gone. And if you can't call anyone, you are so beyond screwed. And it's a little frightening. I've had Google outages when I was, Google has been my primary email forever. And, it almost never happens, but I've had Gmail outages happen while I was on deadline, and that's like so you're calling people up, you're setting up an alternate account, you're transferring stuff. And that's a bad thing, especially when literally there's no one you can talk to try to resolve the situation.
And as the trend toward free cloud services increases, so it's like this total inverse, right? The customer service accessibility decreases. And I mean, Facebook is a perfect example of this, the most important site in the world to some people, the most important thing that they do all day long at 6-minute intervals, check Facebook. And then if you
play
go,
Mafia Wars,
can we put a stop to the Mafia Wars thing?
Down because with it. My mom got into Mafia Wars. I couldn't believe it. I was just like, what?
The least likely people in the world, too. Like, people you would never expect are obsessed with Mafia Wars. So anyway, there it is. Really important. And if you go to the Facebook customer services page, they have a list of most commonly asked questions on Facebook. And the number one question on their most commonly asked question page is, how do I contact Facebook? Because here they are, the most important thing
you
people do all day, and you cannot find them. You cannot get in touch with them. And number two is, how do I delete my account?
Ha!
Which I thought was kind of surprising.
Well, on the Twitter thing, outside of their fail this week, I actually am super excited about the talking that they're doing, because this is the light at the monetary tunnel for Twitter. And I think none of us wants to see Twitter become wholly ad-supported, where all of a sudden we get, ad alerts on our phones. But this is a way.
Sorry, Brian. Are you telling me Google and Microsoft will not monetize Twitter through advertising?
Who knows what they're going to do? But the talk is that they're looking at aggregating all the results of what's happening real time on Twitter and involving it in the search engines, where there's some fabulous data mining to be done. This is literally the pulse of the world at any given time. It's a giant open source, open conversation where all of a sudden, like, there are companies, like Gallup organization, that you have to pay a lot of money for poll results to know whether people like something. Nielsen, the people run these little studies to find out what's going to play well for the public, what's not. And if they could find a way to mine all that, in fact, before it got absorbed into the mothership, Surmise, before it became search.twitter.com and got totally broke, had a really cool thing they were doing where they were taking, you could put in a search word and it would figure out how many positive words were associated with that object versus negative words. And it would actually give you a visualization with red and green and colors in between, which I guess is just brown. I think it was white in this. But all of a sudden you could know, like I remember typing in when Scam School launched to see that, okay, generally people are digging on Scam School. They're mainly saying positive words associated with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that it doesn't, that, well, frankly, the idea of being able to actually monetize anything like this effectively through advertising, at least right now, is not really working out for anybody. So I do assume that they're hoping to make money on data mining. I mean, that alone.
I thought Facebook was making money. Or am I just completely...
Facebook is cash flow positive. They're not necessarily, and that's, that's very different from profitable. They may be able to, we don't know exactly what it means. They're maybe just covering their own expenses but not paying back their investors. But either way, they're getting some money, and I think a lot of that money is coming from data mining. If Twitter could cut those kind of deals, they would need, what's interesting is they'll need a lot more than the 54 million users that they have now. I mean, it's not like they actually are aggregating the entire
world.
It's
a useful service, but it's not, valued at $1 billion useful by any stretch. But you got to remember also, not only do you know what all of America is saying or whatever the segment of America is that's using it, you know by demographic. You can know exactly what 14 to 16-year-old girls are saying about any particular topic at a given time.
If they filled out their profile.
I think most of us do. I did.
Most people do. Yeah, I think so, because everybody's looking for dates.
I think that's a techie thing to do, is to put in a bunch of bogus information. That's something like, I don't think most people, like my mom wouldn't do that. She'd be like, oh, well, they're asking. I got to give the truth.
Absolutely. All right, let's take a little break since we've now annoyed everybody with talking about Twitter. Leo has kindly pre-recorded some ad stuff for us, so I don't have to do it. Take it away, Leo.
Brian Brushwood, Molly Wood, and the gang. So good.
That was spooky.
Schwood and Wood, it's good. I'm sorry. Leo Laporte here. Hello. Didn't mean to interrupt. I just want to mention, I'm driving. It's a drive-by commercial to mention our great friends at Squarespace.com. Have you made a website with Squarespace yet?
Yes.
Look, even if your blog is running on WordPress or another platform, especially if it's running on WordPress or TypePad or Movable Type or Blogger. I want you, you've tried the rest. Now try the best, as they say in the pizza business. Go, go to squarespace.com/twit. No credit card needed. You get a free 2-week trial. You can import all the posts, all the comments, everything from your existing blog, so you can see what it looked like, or forum, or photo gallery. There's a form builder to collect email addresses and other information from site visitors. There's Google Maps, incredible stats, a search engine optimization package that's second to none. They do it all for you, including the hosting. Permissions, access, so that you can have multiple authors. And their cloud architecture allows them to throw more bandwidth online whenever needed. You never get slash-dotted or twitted. And the design feature, I just go on and on, but the best thing to do, and people tell me this, I get email all the time from people who said, hey, you know, I've heard you talk about Squarespace. I finally, you know, said, well, let me give it a shot. And wow, the wow factor very high on this for you and for your visitors. Go to squarespace.com/twit. Try it now. And get 10% off if you decide to sign up when you use the coupon code TWIT. T-W-I-T. We love them. Squarespace, and you will too. And we thank them for supporting the show. Squarespace.com/TWIT. And now here are the stars of our show. Back to Schwood and Wood.
We sound like a crime-fighting duo.
We do, I know. Love it. I think maybe we should start a band, Schwood and Wood. Or at least a website. All right, let's talk a little bit about the moon bombing.
Yes.
The best headline I've seen about about the moon bombing this week was like, it was really exciting for scientists and then the public didn't care. Really?
We love the headline, though. Are you kidding?
Yeah, moon bombing.
We're blowing up the moon. Did you ever see that Mr. Show sketch?
No.
America Blows Up the Moon? That's Justin Robert Young over at WeirdThings.com. That's how he pegged the whole thing. He was like, NASA's blowing up the moon for reals. But instead of the actual link, he linked to the Mr. Show segment where it was all fake news footage of them actually blowing up the moon.
But in this case, so aren't we basically just trying to see if we can go live there?
This is not the first time
looking for water. I know it's not the first time we've looked for water.
But in that same spot, because wasn't there was like an errant satellite that wasn't being used anymore. They had to go down anyway. So they went ahead and they pegged at it roughly the same area on the pole. And they didn't really see anything because they said, it was a long shot. We didn't know if we would actually see anything or not. But this one was actually built for the purpose of finding out if there's a lot of water on there. Which even then, I think they were excited about like maybe 2 or 3% water.
But it sounds like they didn't get the plume of splashiness that they were hoping for. They got sort of, you know, it's too early to tell, but they were like, when they break it down, they said, well, we were looking for a really plumish.
They set up bad expectations. I thought the moon was going to be gone, and I was going to correct them. I was like, you should have gone when it was a full moon, so you make sure you get the whole thing. This is bogus.
They should have kept playing that graphic. It just set expectations so high, that like big animation of what would happen, and then it was like, the photos were just sort of this grainy black and white thing.
Yeah.
What actually happened.
It's such a letdown that animations are so much cooler than real. But I just want to know, I want to have been in the meeting where they said, like, let's just slam a rocket stage into it. Like, you know how we should do this is just, I mean, like.
I can see it now. Like, gentlemen, ideas,
really,
hit me up.
It's like Armageddon, you know? Like,
But the guy who came up with ballistic reentry, which is basically what we used for, you know, Mercury and Apollo and everything, the guy was like, we're going to put a really cool fireproof substance on the bottom of a can, and that's going to, you know, slide through the Earth's atmosphere, and then a parachute's come out. Everybody looked at him like Wile E. Coyote had come to life with a giant box of Acme. You know what I mean?
Yes.
That's how it had to be.
That's how I imagined the meeting. Totally. That he was like, no, seriously, it sounds slapstick, but I think it could work.
Listen, guys, we got about $100 million left in the budget. What do you want to do? I want to shoot a rocket to blow up the moon. Done.
Done.
Actually, apparently the science, they're pretty excited about it. The Wired article was very complimentary on how everything went. Everything was real smooth. And, of course, that's the problem is that the devil's in the details, and you have to wait for all the analysis to find out what this really means long term. But apparently it was a success.
Yes.
Well, if you don't have to shoot water into space, then long term space exploration starts becoming a lot more practical because you can stuff more you know what I mean? It's like hiking
totally.
In
it's,
woods.
It's,
you
what is the cost? $10,000 per pound to send stuff into space right now. And so if you can find the water there, obviously, if you want to live off the land,
you thought Evian was expensive.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, to be fair, they're not probably really looking for ways for us to live there, although, let's be honest, we're going to need a new rock. They are, in fact, hoping to make it like a little pit stop for space exploration. And also, we could live there. So speaking of flashy technology, this, I thought this story was very exciting at news.com.
I just realized that was a pun. Was that a pun?
Yeah.
It was. Oh, that was a good pun.
Thanks.
All right.
Good catch. It sounds like, so we heard, I think, last week about LightPeak, this idea of Intel's LightPeak, which would be a universal connector for computers and other devices, which just sounded like, oh, pie in the sky, water on the moon. Well, at least one company is saying that they may actually be in mass production on LightPeak technology by the beginning of next year, 2010. Can you imagine?
I'm a little bit nervous about, I mean, first
universal
of all, I think it's great that they're moving forward. I'm a little bit nervous about replacing everything with fiber optic cable because you'll notice it says in there, like, it was a big deal that you could curve it to, like, you move the wire into a 1-inch diameter. But it's like with copper, I mean, I don't think any of those wires would survive travel on the road with me anyway for anywhere because it's like, you know, everything gets scrunched up.
No, optical cables. I mean, if you bend it at right angles and beat the hell out of it, optical cables are actually pretty tough.
Are they?
I mean, I'm not going to say they're as tough as copper. You definitely don't want to be bending them at right angles and, well, you know, tying them into knots and stuff. But
let's be fair. There's a real big difference between Brian Brushwood and the average consumer because I don't know if you guys have seen his iPhone, but
I replaced it. It's fine.
Okay.
Everything's fine here.
All right. He's like when you have like a son who's like 5 or 6 and then he breaks everything and you don't even know how it happens.
Because a toddler beating on a drum. I hear you.
I think that's kind of like him. But it does sound like these cables would be at least slightly. But then the other thing, though, is if it was actually a universal connector, like who cares? Because everywhere you go, boom, there will be cables.
That's true.
Because it's universal.
And in fact, I'm in general a fan of people jumping the gun and just not waiting for something to be a settled standard, just to get out there and start making it and getting it in people's hands. And I know it's frustrating when you got to buy stuff all over again, but I'm ready to see the technology progress. Although
it's
Patrick's
supposed
laughing
to be really
at me.
Damn fast, right? I mean, that's the really exciting thing, right? I mean, yeah. I get the whole universal cable thing, but it's supposed to be like super duper crazy fast.
10 gigabits 10 per
gigabits
second.
Per second.
Yep.
Fast enough for video, replace everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I love the concept, but I'd be like, I was covering ultra wideband for a while, and it's like, you know how all those wireless connections we have to our HDTVs right now? Oh wait. There's like, you know what I mean? It's I think it's an awesome concept. I will be delighted if it ships. I will be delighted if it ships next year. I will also be incredibly shocked because cable and wireless cable and faster cable standards. You know what I mean? It always takes forever to roll it out, and then you have to like figure out.
But there's a buzz factor to cash in on. I mean, if a year from now the technology is hyped a lot more, and somebody says, "Guess what? It's here!" You're going to get a substantial number of consumers running out and insisting that their new computer have, you know, whatever just built into it, whether or not it actually works, mm-hmm. whether or not there's anything you can do with it.
Well, spoken like a very hopeful PR rep from a company that's hoping to make a lot of money on this.
No, spoken like a realist who understands that there's a financial benefit to jumping on a bandwagon.
USB was out for like 6 years and on tens of millions of PCs, and it took the iMac, you know what I mean, and Apple beating a bunch of vendors with a stick to come out with USB printers and stuff.
Same thing
but
happened with DVD.
Apple did the same thing with FireWire. I mean, look at FireWire, right?
Well, it never really got beyond Apple.
Which was a standard that was practically dead in the water, or it was just kind of not, it didn't have a ton of traction. All of a sudden, Apple gets behind it in a huge way, and FireWire, then they turn it into this big video standard and then kill it, which was obnoxious. But now they are getting behind LightPeak in the same way. I mean, I think that there's vendor support in a way that could make it. I mean, granted, it's not going to be massively available in 2010. This company's going to start shipping some cables, but it won't be a standard yet. Because they're applying for a USB standard. It won't be in all the hardware yet, but by 2012? You don't think so?
Gina, what do you think? By 2012.
Gina, be positive. What do you think?
I want to go out there. I want really fast cables that'll plug in everything, so I'm going to be hopeful. I don't know. I honestly, I'm not being much of a gadget geek. I haven't followed the history of USB. I'm going to defer to Patrick and you on this. But, you know, I mean, I would love to see it. Hey, if it comes out and people start asking for it, I mean, I'd love to see it. I hope it works out.
Yeah, me too. One thing it sounds like is not going to work out for much longer, DVDs.
Yes, thank goodness. Golf, take forever.
And you know that DVDs are, in fact, on the way out when it's not just like tech-forward streaming nerds like us who are talking about it. It's Netflix CEO Reed Hastings.
This was my favorite story of the week. So excited.
I know, me too. I thought this was phenomenal. He said in an interview with Motley Fool that DVD would only be the primary delivery format for Netflix for the next 2 years. Like, he basically said DVD, at least for us. That's what we do.
Can I tell you, that's already, like, I subscribed to Netflix a long time ago, and I sat, like, the physical media they sent, first disc I got was Michael Clayton. I sat on it for 6 months. Now, keep in mind, I'm watching all the movies on the streaming. I'm watching all the series. You know, we just finished all of Weeds on the streaming service. And meanwhile, that one disc sat there, so finally we sent it back, but now we've changed. Now, instead of sitting on one disc for 6 months and then sending it back, we get the disc, we sit on it for 2 days, and then send it back. Like, I literally don't think I've watched a single movie. We've gone through, like, 25 discs, and I don't think I've bothered to. I just can't be bothered. You got to take the disc, and you got to put it in the tray, and it's like, oh, the freaking FBI warning. Oh,
oh, I
and
know.
And then it's scratch, and you have to, like, rub toothpaste on it or get the pledge out.
Oh, wait. Get all life hacker on us. What now with the toothpaste and the pledge?
The pledge will help with a scratch DVD for sure. But you got to go to the mailbox and pick it up. And, it's annoying. Yes. So DVD's out and I'll put the link in. That's what I say. By 2012.
Sorry, you got to go to the mailbox and pick it up. It's so annoying.
Oh,
that's like
yes.
So 21st century.
It is. Sometimes, I don't know. We don't.
I have to leave the couch to get a movie? That's unacceptable.
Come on. My mailbox is, you know, not at the house. I've got a mailbox down the road.
No, I'm right with you, dude. This is driving me nuts. I'm actually over physical media.
I have the same annoyance with that. I have to put the thing in the thing. That's how lazy I have become as a human, where I'm just like, I have to go all the way over there and open it. And my DVD player's old, and it takes a long time for the drawer to open. And then I have to move it because it's a changer. Next disc.
And then the worst are the ads that you can't skip
past. The ads you can't skip are ludicrous. But so what? So Hastings didn't specifically say, and this is what is kind of interesting, what would take over for DVD? What would supplant DVD? I think we are all assuming streaming.
Oh, streaming has gone so well. It's so good enough, and it's so fast, and it's so easy. I mean,
yeah. And Netflix is so everywhere. Yeah. They're in every device now.
Yeah. There was a fascinating article in Wired magazine talking about that decision. They were originally going to be another box on your shelf, and instead they last minute scrubbed it and said, let's just be on everything and be a software platform. And I think it's worked out great for them.
Good decision on their part, for sure. Kudos to them for being forward-thinking and saying, you know, this primary thing that we made money doing, you know, ain't happening anymore, and being forward-thinking, for sure.
Yeah, well, I think it's... Go ahead.
They originally said there was like almost 2020 originally for DVDs, and the Hastings is only, he basically says they expect to keep handling DVDs for another decade at least.
Right.
I don't know if the bandwidth is going to cope to getting, you know what I mean? I like streaming movies, but I also like extra features. I also like the resolution quality on Blu-ray.
Well, I think
lot better than 720p over like stream compression. Streaming has to evolve.
Yeah,
the good enough market is big, but it's going to be interesting also to watch Hollywood still shaking out what it wants to do next. And you know, the availability on DVD versus the availability on streaming, there's still a great big wide chasm in between.
Yeah, but I tell you, it's been massively exploding in the last year. Because you remember earlier this year, that's when he was saying it's going to be 2018 till we stop handling physical media. The DVD is still our primary mode of distribution. And what I think's happening is I think we've seen a tipping point. All of a sudden, people are jumping on board. It's getting easier for them to go to developers and say, we want your content, and we want, you know, we have this distribution method that's secure, that's probably not going to get ripped off, and people are going on. I think in the next year you're going to see a massive explosion of the Netflix online library, and I couldn't be happier.
I hope for that, but it's also, don't confuse Netflix's business model with the entire business model for people that distribute video. They're not the same thing.
They're not the same thing, but you have to admit that Netflix is at the forefront of a trend that is increasingly important. And it's important because the places that people consume media are exploding themselves, right? It's not about anymore just sitting in front of your TV.
No, I mean, and watching on HD Nation, people are confused about, like, do I get a Blu-ray player? Do I get a set-top box? Do I need to get a separate one? Do I get a home theater PC?
Yeah.
You know, do I buy an LG so I can have integrated Netflix? Well, I can't use a PS3, but I can use my Xbox 360. And it's also still a real super mess for a lot of people having the Xbox 360.
Well, and still for the high-end experience.
The high-end experience
is definitely going to be Blu-ray for the foreseeable future. But meanwhile, the good enough market, it's going to be Netflix streaming, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. I agree, Patrick, that I think that the hard thing is going to be bandwidth. It's going to be hard for people to keep up with the bandwidth to do that kind of streaming, especially as the trend in ISPs is to do more throttling and to say we don't.
And more caps.
And to do caps, exactly. Right. To say we don't want to deal with this.
You know. I mean, because there's the 5 gigabyte and 40 gigabyte caps. You can, I mean, a 5 gigabyte cap is 3 movies. You know what I mean? The 40 gigabyte cap, if you know, if you've got a toddler that hits play a lot, you can destroy a 40 gigabyte cap in like a week.
Very true. But I think there's no, to me, there's no question though that that's where we're headed. That we are headed toward an on-demand kind of all streaming world, and that it's going to take us a long time to get there. But I think the idea that Netflix realizes that it's not going to be delivering the DVDs as the majority for very much longer, I think is really true. And I think that Blu-ray is never going to be as big as the DVD because it's going to be supplanted by streaming.
By the way, in addition to my prediction that a year from now, streaming will be way huger than it is now, I also predict that we'll be having a twit where we discuss the great Netflix outage of 2011.
I was writing that critical point of my favorite movie, and they cut out on me. Those bastards. They lost everything.
Yeah, this Facebook nonsense, that's nothing compared to the fury.
Compared to, like, I was right in the middle of the True Blood cliffhanger. Disaster. Well, there's no question that the whole trend is toward digital, including books. And the Kindle.
Oh, very smooth.
I know, right?
Very smooth. You're
getting,
out of roll. You're out of control.
Like, it's like tacky at this point.
She's good.
Just tacky to be so obvious. Amazon cut the price of the Kindle this week, added a global version, which everyone was very... So the Kindle now, the Kindle 2 is $259, and they added a GSM version that will work internationally on AT&T's network and partner networks. And then... That was really, everybody was really positive about that news, except for me, because I have a Kindle 2 already, and it's CDMA, and I'm not going to get that. And you're just shaking your head no matter what,
I'm shaking my head because it's, I mean, number one, very smart, right direction, because it's obvious that there's a market for this kind of device, and whoever gets there first owns the market, at least in the public's mind. So this is all very smart for Amazon. Unfortunately, I don't think they're cutting the price nearly enough to grab enough of the market. It's got to be $99 for me to hop on board. They got to take bigger losses on this if they want to actually own that market. Because right now, like most, like what I would be most excited about with a Kindle would be to read my regular websites, you know, to actually treat it like a daily newspaper kind of device. Mm-hmm. But the problem is I can already do that with my iPhone for the most part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the reading experience is so much better on a Kindle compared to having read novels on both platforms. The Kindle was much more enjoyable and continues to be much more enjoyable than reading on my iPhone.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think
but also, you know, they're in a race. If the rumors are true about the Apple tablet device and if it's actually going to try to be a reader device, then they have to own that market. They have to say, nice try, Apple, but we already own this.
Mm-hmm. Although, I don't know. Gina, what do you think about the price? The $259, I have argued for a long time that the Kindle was not too expensive, but it is possible that as competition creeps up, that might be a problem. $259, what do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. I think I kind of agree. I'm with Brian on this one. I think it needs to go a little lower. I mean, I love my Kindle. And so do all of us here have a Kindle?
I have
one. No, I do not.
You do not. Patrick,
and you
yes.
Do not. Okay.
Gina, yes.
I do have one, but I got one, you know, when like Oprah did her big discount thing, like I had a gift certificates and stuff, you know, cause I'm kind of cheap and, you know, I wasn't sold on the idea. So I do kind of think that the price needs to come down for people to really get on board. But the reading experience is definitely much, much better on the Kindle. Although I don't use it to read websites. I use it to read books, like long form books. Websites,
I'm too far down the Audible rabbit hole. Like not that I love reading online. I love reading books occasionally if I'm sitting on the beach or something, but far and away I'm chewing through a book a week at least doing online audiobooks.
Mm-hmm. You're not gonna take the Kindle on a beach.
That's very true. When I bought the Kindle, actually, I felt like I had this big dilemma because I had this big pile of IRL books, like mm-hmm. in real life books, that I felt like I was betraying because I had the Kindle thing and it was a little awkward. But I actually think that what's coming out, I don't know, I get weird. I used to be that way about stuffed animals too, like that bear's gonna kill me in the night because I played with the other one.
No, I was just laughing because I was like, I thought I was the only person who thought about it that way. Like the books are looking at the Kindle and being really pissed off about it.
I did. I was like, sure, that they felt kind of offended, you know. The ones that, you know, like the Water for Elephants was sitting there on the shelf. Like, seriously, really? You've been ignoring me for like a year and a half and now you got a Kindle?
And then how many books did you buy on the Kindle and not quite read? Because it's a book buying machine as much as it is a book reading machine. It is like a compulsive book buying machine.
Now you know how all my DVDs feel. Just sit there on the shelf. The Netflix DVDs, like, streaming, come on, dude. You've had me for six. Come on.
Look at my beautiful cover. I know, but Gina, you're... my disc.
You're totally right. Like, I have gotten into a situation basically now where if my friends get too many beers in me, I'll buy just about any book. Like, it's ludicrous. You just whip that. Like, okay.
Oh, yeah. That's a good book. I'm buying $10. It right now. Look at me. Look at me buying the book. Look.
I need I need a probation period. I need for the Kindle to have a little probation period where you have a grace period after you buy a book, after you make the ill-advised infinite jest purchase, yeah. Like to be able to just return it.
That's why I keep down sample chapters.
Instead of drunk dialing, it's the drunk kindling problem.
It is.
Don't let friends kindle drunk.
Yeah, I know that makes me a giant nerd that I have drunk Kindle bot, but it happened.
That'll be interesting when somebody grabs your Kindle and kind of peruses your library and he's like, you know, really? The Da Vinci Code, really?
You're like, shh. I did a video actually on how to hide embarrassing books on your Kindle as a how-to. Because it is such, because you buy anything for one thing, and then the Kindle, it turns out, is a huge vector for softcore porn. That, like, there have been a couple of studies that basically say that the best-selling titles on the Kindle are basically erotic fiction. Because everyone's like, awesome, now I can read this on the bus and no one can see. But the problem with the Kindle is that it's such an attention magnet that people grab it and pick it up and start looking through your, you know, and you're like, ha, 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 ha. Put that down. Anyway.
No, on there. Uh-oh. Robot. Whoa, we got Robo Patrick.
We'll call him back. In the meantime, though, we will talk a little bit about some other competition for the Kindle, which is Barnes & Noble planning to do an ebook reader. The thing so far is that everybody who announces the plans to do an ebook reader, like the IREX, they're still talking about $400, although I don't think there's pricing yet on what Barnes & Noble might do. I mean, don't you kind of feel like, really? Barnes & Noble? E-reader? How cute.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, the difference between first place and second place, that's it's a race, and Amazon's just running away with it right now.
Yeah. Is Sony in it, you guys think, with their reader? I mean, it's like Sony was actually there first.
They were first, but they weren't first in the mind of the customer, and that's what really matters.
Right. Yeah, that's true. What? Is Android involved with this new Barnes & Noble reader, supposedly? Is that the rumor?
Yeah, it's expected to run the Android operating system. And then if it ran that and then it had wireless downloads, maybe.
Interesting.
Yeah. I don't know. I do feel like the Kindle is the kind of the iPhone of the ebook market.
Definitely. And
one you get if you're, you know.
The parallels are so right. It's first in the mind of the customer, and it's also the way they're doing the $9.99 per book is modeling right off of iTunes, 99 cents. Everyone griped about the 99 cents download to begin with, but it was very effective to grabbing everyone's attention and pinning it in their mind that, oh, I can get songs for a buck. And now it's like, oh, I could get any book for $10.
Right. Plus it's white.
Yep.
Wow, racist.
That was really well thought out in market analysis. It's also white like the other one.
And clean.
All right, I'm not going to dig myself any deeper. Let's go ahead and take another break and listen to some Leo, shall we?
Schwood and Wood. Thank you, gang. We're going to get back to you guys in just a bit, but I wanted to mention, I know I'm in Dubai, but I can't help it. Dial in via time machine and tell you about GoToMeeting from the great folks at Citrix. It's a great way to meet online with clients and colleagues, a great way to collaborate. According to American Express, and they ought to know, the average cost of a business trip is $10,000 for one trip. And let me tell you something, if you're going to Dubai, it's a heck of a lot more and a lot longer. And there's such a better way to meet with clients and colleagues, whether they're across town or around the world, with GoToMeeting. Forget $1,000. How about $49 a month for unlimited meetings, as long as you want, as many as you want? You start your GoToMeeting with a single click of the mouse. In fact, you could send out Outlook invitations automatically, or you could just start a meeting as you're on the phone. It's so easy. You just say, hey, look, I got to show you this PowerPoint. I want to show you these drawings. Go to GoToMeeting.com. This is what you tell your clients or your colleagues. Go to GoToMeeting.com. Press the Join a Meeting button. Here's the meeting ID. You give them a 9-digit number. Boom, they're seeing your computer on their screen. It's beautiful. There's a chat on the side. There's you meeting attendees. This is designed for online meeting. It is slick. It's elegant. Yeah, because it's from Citrix. They've had years to design this and make it the best. Very fast. You're not sitting there waiting for the slides to change. They keep up with you. I've used it for our shows. A number of our shows use GoToMeeting. When we have remote hosts like Ray Maxwell, he'll use GoToMeeting to show us his screens. It's so great. I want you to try it right now. Go to gotomeeting.com/twit, gotomeeting.com/twit. You can try it free for 30 days, a month of unlimited online meetings. You get voice over IP. You get phone conferencing free. award-winning. MPC World keeps giving it their best-in-class award for online access. I mean, there's nothing better for this, for online meetings. Nothing better for this. I think this is just a must-try application. Will you try it right now? Go to gotomeeting.com/twit. You've heard me talk about it. Why wait? Give it a try today. We thank Citrix so much for supporting our shows. gotomeeting.com/twit. Now back, my friends, to Schwood and Wood.
The crime-fighting duo.
He's having a little too much fun with that Schwood and Wood business. Wow. Me too, though, now that I said it fast like that.
What's you saying now? So, okay.
I know. All right, let's go to everybody's favorite topic, patent infringement lawsuits. Hooray! Good times. This is a major, though. Eolus, which is the company that won $585 million from Microsoft when they sued them for patent infringement.
Floodgates are open now.
Is feeling flushed with success, not surprisingly. That happened in 2003. They have now sued 23 companies, including, maybe you've heard of them, Apple, Google, Adobe, Amazon, eBay, Playboy, Yahoo, and YouTube, among many others.
You know, there's one of those. One of those kind of stuck out for the. Could you go down that list again?
One of those just kind of popped out at me. I don't know.
Yeah, eBay. Yeah.
Yeah, that might have been it. That might have been it
for their use of the the plugins. All right, we're going off the rails. They have sued these companies for implementing browser plugins in one form or another. You know, browser plugins. And then another patent, they've sued over another patent that addresses the use of AJAX, asynchronous JavaScript and XML. So this feels like the kind of thing, since these patents have actually been upheld a couple of times by the patent office, that has the potential to change a lot about the way the web works, at least in terms of, I don't know, websites having to pay high licensing fees before they...
Well, when I first, it sounded to me like it's a legitimate claim. I mean, if it was right against... I mean, if anyone's going to put up an active defense of this, it's going to be Microsoft. And once Microsoft goes down, and if they're in the right against Microsoft, I'm thinking they're in the right against everyone else. I'd be interested to hear what Patrick has to say about it.
Mm-hmm. This is Patrick Bate right here.
I mean, I didn't actually get a chance to read this one. Is Eolus a holding company that bought the technology patents and has a whole flood of lawyers? Or are they just one of those quiet little companies that nobody knew about that got a bunch of patents back in the 80s?
The story I heard it was that they're the real deal.
They are the patent holders. Eolus and the University of California were granted the patents themselves. Yeah, they didn't. It's not like they bought it as part of a portfolio.
Okay, yeah, because there was some interesting stuff actually going around JPEG and other places where companies were being acquired. Basically, somebody, you know, did a round of funding, gathered a bunch of lawyers, and started combing through IP that they bought to look for stuff that they could use to leverage for lawsuits to generate more capital as a business. Man, you know, what I'm more scared of is that these guys claim that they have a patent that predates AJAX being implemented. That just sucks. You know what I mean? Like it's kind of like, you know, MPEG-4 is actually completely tied up in MPEG-4 is completely owned and completely patentable, chargeable. And one of the interesting things is, you know, looking at like MPEG-2 and MPEG-4, which has been exempt from licensing fees for nonprofit use, which essentially means consumer use, and for businesses that are basically doing short videos or online distribution. And if the patent holders wanted to, they could essentially charge every single person that distributes video online a fee for the use of that, the way they do for people who create Blu-rays or large corporate sites to distribute video. So, you know. You know, it's like welcome to patent law. You own a patent, you defend a patent, you collect cash, and then you start collecting more and more cash.
Well, yeah, but it definitely sounds like this is beyond patents as business plan, although potentially even more scary. Well, Gina, you look like you were biting your tongue there too.
I'm confused about this. So this patent is a claim that on a program running inside of a web browser specifically, like any plugin running inside of a web browser?
Yeah, essentially a program that runs within another program. It addresses...
Oh, it's actually even worse than that, Gina. The summary I'm reading here is the 906 patent, 5,838,906 in U.S. patent, 7,599,985. The 906 patent broadly covers any mechanism that can be used to embed an object within a web document. Yeah. And when Eolus says object, it means any applets or plugins.
So anything embedded within a web document. Okay.
QuickTime, ActiveX controls, Windows Media Player, Sun's Java Virtual Machine, and any web browser that automatically invokes each applet and plugin when you click on an appropriate link are in violation of EOLS's patents. This is from Computer World. And so basically they're saying anything that's embedded in a web browser, we own the rights to embed anything in a web browser in any way, in any fashion.
Can it's I a little ridiculous.
Vague.
Yeah, it's well, the thing is, it's so vague that it is utterly terrifying, right? Because potentially, yikes, what is not covered? But then, right. Then the question that I have is, why does this patent keep getting upheld?
Yeah, I mean, this is like trying to patent, like, this is a design pattern, like embedding, yeah. You know, a program to run within another program happen. You know, I mean, I guess you could say web document is another program, but it's like, this is just weird. It's like saying patenting, like, I don't know, putting a paragraph in a document. I mean, it sounds crazy to me.
I own the patent on putting words inside a book.
Yeah.
Well, what's looking at it's Stephen J. Vaughn, actually. Vaughn Nichols wrote this up for Computer World. And what he's saying is that even Tim Berners-Lee has written the United States Patent Office and said, look, there's pre-existing art here. They did not invent this. Right. And there people are listing previous browsers that are doing this because these patents came fairly late.
Yeah.
Hopefully, you know, that will help.
Yeah, I hope so. It was granted in 98. So you figure if Tim Berners-Lee says there was prior art, he probably made it.
And that's Sir Tim Berners-Lee.
And the whole Ajax thing makes no sense either. Ajax is not a plugin. JavaScript is a framework. And it fetches data just the way that any web document is fetched. Like, I'm confused about how that
works. But it's an object that acts within a browser. We came up with the idea that you could put something inside of a web browser window. The United States Patent Office gave us the approval for that. Yeah,
which,
now
exactly,
I'm really
right? Which
off.
You, I believe, have hit on the most salient and germane point of all, which is that the U.S. Patent Office not only granted a patent on that, like the idea of patenting a word inside a book, but then they have upheld it 3 times since then. They have said, no, that sounds totally reasonable. Like, you have, in essence, if read properly by the right and most clever lawyer, you have patented almost everything about the way the web works today. So go crazy. Get your lawsuit boots on because you're going dancing. Yeah. Like, it's unbelievable. Oof. I don't know. I just feel kind of at a loss. I mean, I hope that, I don't know, that someone comes to their senses. Otherwise, I guess everybody's just going to have to pay this guy and then invent a new internet.
Unless somebody wants to fight. I mean, is Microsoft going to fight this all the way to the Supreme Court?
No, Microsoft's paid, I think, right?
Yeah. You know. Because they were fighting with EOLS for like a decade, apparently.
Yeah.
Which is a long time to be... Well, I mean, obviously Microsoft has money and a lot of in-house lawyers, but
the
ouch. Kind
of, the only ray of hope that we have is that the Supreme Court is currently reviewing the issue of whether software should be patentable.
Right. Altogether.
Because the idea of software patents is really fuzzy, right? I mean, there's so much prior art involved. There's so much... It's not like as much of a cut and dried invention. A lot of them are so broad that they lead to these kinds of problems.
Wow.
Yeah. So I guess there's some hope there. less hope for YouTube in its defense against Viacom, an exclusive on news.com.
Billion dollar lawsuit.
There's a $1 billion lawsuit, and then it turns out some emails surfaced that showed, kind of not surprisingly in my opinion, that YouTube employees knew that there was unauthorized content on YouTube.
Yeah.
And but, didn't take it down, and then may have even uploaded that content themselves.
Well, like, it made it sound like individual employees at YouTube may have uploaded the account. And I don't know that that should really be a big factor. But, well, I don't know, actually. I don't know anything, first of all. But that seems like less of the crime. But the idea that if they totally did know that there was... that there was illegal content being uploaded, and as an official policy, they did not do anything about it. That's a bummer.
And they left an email trail, which is even more horrifying.
Yeah.
Because lawsuits aren't about what's right or what's wrong. It's about what you can prove in a court of law against this standing, you know what I mean? It's just, ouch.
Yeah, it's pretty heavy duty because, I mean, I think pretty clearly YouTube whatever YouTube has become now, it rose to prominence on the back of pirated content, in my opinion. I know that that was the first time I ever heard of YouTube.
No, totally.
Was when I think it was some cartoon I wanted to watch, and that was the first place it showed up, mm-hmm. allegedly.
Yeah, I think there's no question. There's no question that back in the day, and that's kind of the question, right? It was back in the day when everybody was still pretty fuzzy on how much you could violate copyright and what was fair use and what wasn't, and YouTube obviously built its reputation on that kind of content and knew about it and probably did upload its own stuff. But you're right, Patrick. The problem is that there are evidently emails about it, and if the reason that it's such a problem is that it would mean that YouTube, now owned by Google, couldn't qualify for safe harbor under the DMCA, which...
Right. Well, and the system they have now, where you wait for a takedown, and then once it's brought to their attention mm-hmm. by the owner, they take it down. I think it's a pretty good system, but obviously that wasn't how it always was. And certainly, if there's evidence clearly showing that their policy was, let it ride, we're getting famous, then that's going to be a problem. And maybe Viacom yeah. does deserve a chunk of change in compensation for unwittingly being the engine that rose YouTube to prominence.
Yeah. Or maybe Viacom could just back off and admit that the Daily Show is where it is right now because of YouTube.
Well, that's the two sides of the coin, right? It's like on the one hand, clearly they derive a massive benefit from YouTube and it works both ways. So I don't know. Freaking lawsuits.
I mean, really, do you think that, Gina, do you think that it's possible that Viacom lost money because of YouTube?
Absolutely not. No way. I don't think so. But... I don't know anything either.
No. I think you're right. I don't think Viacom actually lost any money. But whatever YouTube is valued at, I think you could definitely say that some percentage of that value is derived from the Viacom content that was on YouTube for a long time.
I mean, I would argue it was a mutually beneficial situation. Mm-hmm.
I would agree.
Regardless
with that,
of the legal technicalities of it, shows got more viewers because of YouTube. YouTube got more viewers because of shows, and that's my opinion on how it went down. Although. Obviously, I have absolutely no numbers to support that, but...
my gut tells me, my finely honed gut tells me that's probably true. And then, if you use the argument that YouTube owes Viacom some kickback because that was the content they used, then, Google would owe everybody on the web a lot of money.
And I don't know. And I understand.
I sort of feel like everybody should just give a little handshake and walk away.
Right. That's what it seems like to me. And I know that that with the lawsuit, it's game theory. You got to ask for the moon, even if it's blown up. But in this case, I mean, $1 billion. $1 billion.
Yeah. Come on. That's a little RIAA of them.
I love that you just used RIAA as a synonym for a word I'm probably not going to say on this show.
Yep, nope. That's why I used that word. Instead of any other ones. Bloggers are, this was the other kind of big news of the week. Bloggers are now under the watchful eye of the Federal Trade Commission.
This terrifies me.
Does it? How come?
Really?
Because now I'm in that boat.
You take payola?
Well, no. Mm-hmm. But like I'm compensated by my sponsors. And now when I want to talk up how great Squarespace is, by the way, Squarespace is a sponsor of Scam School, which pays Brian Brushwood. It's like I'm affected by that. Now I can't say necessarily what I love. I have to go back in my mental Rolodex and say, well, I don't know. Am I being compensated by them in any way?
Yeah, but if you're being compensated by them, isn't there like an ad?
Well, there is an ad, but yeah. Like when I Twitter about Squarespace, hey everyone, check out my new Squarespace page.
Oh, do
I'm
you
very
have
proud
to say
it.
Every single time
that's
that you're
by right. the letter of law, you have to disclose. Same thing with Audible. I just said how much I love Audible, how I don't read many books in physical media anymore because I'm too busy doing audiobooks. Audible's not a sponsor. Yeah, so anyway, I love audiobooks. I mean, they're not a sponsor to me personally.
There was a pretty good interview with one of the principals at the FTC. He's like, look, everybody's freaking out, which is what the blogosphere does best, right?
Right.
And he's, basically what he said is the scumbag rule is in effect. You know what I mean? The law was applied to people who are like, people who go out of their, people who are not, the most amazing thing about the Ford is that it's so wonderful and it's so this and it's so that and it's so, you know what I mean? And they want the blogger to basically be like, yeah, Ford gave me this car, you know.
Right. Yeah, and but what I'm saying is I hate that defense because it's so it's the Patriot Act defense. It's like, oh no, we're not really going to use these sneaky peeks on you.
This is not the Patriot Act. The Patriot Act is one of the most scumbaggy, weaselly, sad, and pathetic pieces of.
All right, well, let's pick a different one. It's the seatbelt law defense. Then, oh, we're not going to pull you over for not wearing your seatbelts. We're just going to, if we pull you over and we see that you don't have your seatbelt on, well, then we'll give you a ticket. You know, it's only we're not going to pull you over for that one thing. Whatever it is, whenever you use it's a slippery slope, and especially when you deal with government, I really dislike anything that has the little asterisk saying, but we're not really going to enforce it the way it says. We won't misuse this. It's like, well, this is how it begins. I don't like it.
Okay, so basically bloggers and people on the internet should be able, and marketing, more importantly, marketing companies should be able to take advantage of all of the online media out there to sell whatever they want, however they want, by pretending they are whoever they want to pretend they are, being honest on the interwebs, and there should be no recourse for the protection of consumers.
Oh, question. I'll not fall for your debate tomfoolery, my friend. I'll avoid that trap. The point is like, by the letter of the law, what it says, I don't have $11,000 laying around, and I hate the idea that now that I'm, you know, my little tiny square inch of the public spotlight, I have to be careful about what I say as a result of this law. It's driving me nuts.
I think that is totally reasonable. It is totally reasonable to say, look, you have a duty at the minimum to just be honest with people that if you're talking about a product because, and it's not, I really don't believe that it's going to come down to, like, you mentioned Squarespace and you actually personally like them and they also happen to be a sponsor. It's more like if Squarespace gave you 10 free accounts, right? If there was not an ad for them on your page, if they just said, here's 10 free accounts, no reason. And then you talk about how, you know, or flat out said, and some companies have really said, here's a free car, please talk about it. You know, I mean, I think that these are the kinds of rules that could actually protect bloggers. Like, there was a big thing about mommy bloggers a couple years ago, and it has been ongoing since, where that became a really big lucrative segment of the blogging population. And all of a sudden, these mommy bloggers were getting inundated with free stuff, and it was predatory. I mean, they didn't know any better. They're not journalists. And I think that they were
a lot of journalists don't know any better, by the way.
Yeah. A lot of journalists don't know any better either. Exactly. But I think on the one hand, it can protect bloggers from being used by companies who are saying, like, we want to use you for free publicity. And then on the other hand, I don't think there's anything wrong with basically saying you shouldn't be allowed to lie to the people who trust and like to read you.
Yeah, I totally agree. I don't have a problem with this at all. I mean, this is a disclosure has always been something that I've tried to do all the time. I don't think there's anything wrong with saying, you know, I really like this thing, and oh, by the way, they've paid me. You know, junkets, review units, all these things. I don't know. I think it's a good thing. Yeah. I don't have a problem with it. I think everybody should be doing it anyway, and I don't have any problem with it being laid out in the law.
Yeah, I think it's a best effort kind of thing. I don't think you have to be that scared. Yeah. Although, Brian maybe should be terrified.
I was about to say.
He's the guy who's going to deliver our next ad.
Everyone in the chat room has been wondering what this card I was handed just says. And it says, Schwood will do Audible Platinum ad, as I was warned 5 minutes ago. But but it's true. You know, I mean, it's like, I guess it goes back. It ties the room together real nicely, not unlike a certain rug. But I don't read a lot of physical books. I'm glad you enjoyed
Two
that.
Points.
and I don't, because I'm doing audiobooks all the time. I'm on the road 200 days out of the road, and I chew through books because I do it all the time. I do it while I'm doing chores around the house, while I'm waiting in line for the TSA to manhandle me, except I take it out for TSA because you have to, while I'm on the plane, while I'm driving. This is all downtime. This is when my brain would normally be in screensaver mode, but instead I'm able to experience all the best books out there. And in fact, I'm like Leo, because Leo talks about, he makes it sound like, you know, he's the only crazy guy that listens to so many books per month. I'm right up there with them, and that's why we're talking about the Platinum edition, the Platinum Audible at audible.com/twit2. Twit2. You got to add the 2 in there. And it looks like how many? Yeah, you get 2 free audiobooks to try it out, or 1 gigundo mega-sized book as well. And in fact, that's what I'm going to recommend, because I am knee-deep, and I mentioned it earlier a little while ago. I had never heard of Peter F. Hamilton, but I started reading Pandora's Star, which takes place 300 years in the future, where it's kind of like, I don't know, it's a really neat world to sink your eyes into, or your mental, your picture to picture yourself in, because it's a world where every 60 or 70 years, people go and they get a tune-up. And if, essentially, they reset their body back to 20 years old. So as a result, you have this kind of epic tale that takes years and years. I don't want to spoil too much about it. It starts off so random and so bizarre, but by the time it's over, you've experienced such an epic story that I'm actually on to the second series that takes place 1,000 years after that and actually has some of the same characters from the first one. Pandora's Stars, the first one, is called The Commonwealth Saga. You can choose it at audible.com/twit2 as one of your books on the Platinum plan.
I sense a Kindle impulse buy in my future, personally.
It's big. Maybe it's a long one.
Maybe you can email me about that later. all right, let's do the wrap up real quick so that we don't get accused of doing an overlong twit. Even though it's kind of short by twit standards.
It is kind of short.
I'm skipping ahead, though, because I just, frankly, I only want to talk about Ralph Lauren going after Boing Boing.
Yes!
Because of the Photoshop model. This is my favorite story of the entire week and possibly the year.
And it doesn't get really good until you see the picture, because yes! I read it, and I'm on a slow connection at this hotel. And so I'm actually reading the story, and then halfway through the story, the picture shows up to my right. And alone in my hotel room, I burst out laughing because I could not believe. I thought for sure this was a joke that somebody had. I thought that the end of this was going to be that it was a bogus story, because there's no way this cartoon stick figure could ever be thought to be intended as a real person.
A real human.
But yeah. Then apparently it was. They copped to it. They admitted, yeah, that's supposed to be a person.
Yeah. Did you guys... Yeah,
that made it through its editorial process.
I was utterly dumbfounded. And I think Zenny Jardin had maybe the best headline of the year, too, when she originally wrote it up. And she said something about, like, they're now selling... Ralph Lauren has opened up a new store in the Uncanny Valley. Right?
That's exactly what it is.
Like, get that girl a Webby just for that. Because it does. It looks like some sort of terrifying android creature. And she said, so it showed up originally on, what is it, terriblephotoshop.com or the Photoshop Disasters. And it was this ad where they had retouched this woman to the point where, as Zenny put it, dude, her head's bigger than her pelvis.
It's true. Like somebody in the chat room described her as looking like the alien at the end of Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Serious. And then her one hand is like almost gone. And then it couldn't look less natural. But so then, rather than cop to it originally, though, and this is where the story gets super awesome, Ralph Lauren came after Boing Boing and accused them of, everybody's favorite club for the stupid, copyright
infringement. Yes.
For reprinting the ad. Yeah. They said, you reprinted our intellectual property when you were making fun of this terrible editorial work that we've done here.
Right. And placed that we placed in a public forum. And now we're shocked that you're discussing it in a public forum.
The hurrah. The hurrah. But they did eventually. What, Gina?
It's just such a great story. It was just delicious. It just kept getting better and better.
Yeah. I know. I agree. And I just, frankly, I can't stop looking at the picture. I want to move on and finish up, but I just can't.
It's hypnotic. Try to look away.
They did.
If I were that model, I'd be pissed.
I know. Wouldn't you?
Well, I'm sure. You know what? I wonder how she felt before the controversy. I wonder if she looked at that and just kind of went, all right, whatever. Or if she feels different now that it's sort of a big hubbub kind of thing.
I wonder.
I want to meet her in person and just see.
That's the real twist at the end of this story. Ralph Lauren comes out and like, sorry, that's no Photoshop.
What's funny, though, it's like, okay, her pelvis is at an angle to the camera. It's probably about 30, 40 degrees long. Her chest and her head is directly facing the camera. She's probably like 5'10 and 120 pounds, which is... I used to work in a part of Manhattan that was basically rife with modeling agencies and photographers' lofts up in the Flatiron District. And, you know, it was kind of, you know, being a squat little punk rock guy wearing his dad's leather jacket and a pair of red Keds surrounded by people wearing, you know, Armani suits back when Armani suits were a status symbol and not a, you know, punchline. And models like walking to agencies, you could really feel like... small and squat and ugly, and everyone else is wearing nice clothes. And
this
they're
is how
pretty
you wanted to
tall.
Look, is what you're saying.
Just don't look at them.
I don't think I know. I've never really gone into the looking like a weird Brooke Shields.
You wanted to be the meatball on a noodle. That was your look you were going for.
I wanted one of those beautiful suits and a pair of, you know, $2,000 handcrafted shoes, or at least not to look, you know, like the one guy in the neighborhood that couldn't afford a really expensive car. you know, I have since obviously matured. I now live in hoodies and shorts, and I am much happier for it. But the I don't know, man. It's modeling in general is filled with people who are anatomically bizarre compared to the most of the population.
Come on, though. True. There are limits. I mean, that's totally true, although there are limits. There, I've definitely seen the people that you're talking about where you question how they could even exist, really. But this is, like, terrifying. Anyway, Ralph Lauren did eventually cave to the fairly obvious argument that, in fact, that was not copyright infringement and are you crazy? And then said, okay, you're right. As it turns out, we have learned that we are responsible for the poor imaging and retouching that resulted in a very distorted image of a woman's body. I don't even think you need to worry about little girls seeing this and feeling like that, you know, they need to lose weight. I think you have to worry about them seeing this and having nightmares.
Yeah. No kidding. Well, what do they say? Like, they even went all the way around and said the very distorted image. It wasn't even like, what? She's too thin for you guys? You know, they acknowledge, like, yeah, that's a freak, dude. Like,
I've got a friend who is a counselor and a dietitian that works with children with eating disorders. And, you know, when you talk to somebody who deals day in and day out with, you know, teenagers and younger who have completely destroyed any normal relationship they have with their body image, you know, because of you know, them wanting to be the advertising or some extreme distorted version of it as it gets filtered through their psyche. You know what I mean? Like, on one hand, like, you know, kiss my ass, Ralph Lauren. I mean, you know, yeah, if you are photoshopping this and beating it, but it's the entire industry. It's Hollywood. It's the expectations everybody has. And it's brutal to anybody who doesn't exactly fit into that for a lot of people.
It's a bummer that it takes a case like this. Like, it's a bummer that Ralph Lauren actually did this on purpose, because otherwise this is a great topic of discussion to bring about how ridiculous the imagery is that they're putting out there.
Right.
So three cheers for Dove soap.
Yeah, that was the best viral video.
Yeah, that's good stuff. I know, absolutely.
Well, I was thinking of the print ads they did on all the bus stops and stuff were around here. And it was interesting to watch people react to that. Like, you know, she's not very skinny. And it's just like, well, yeah, it's the whole point of the ad, dude. It's like irony, and you're just living too close.
That don't seem right to me, that billboard. Not sure why. All right, I think we're going to call it there. And I am really excited about the... Okay, well, first, I promised that I would do this earlier, and now here we go. It's pimping time!
Yeah!
Brian Brushwood, what are you working on?
What am I pimping? I'm pimping Scam School, the only show dedicated to social engineering at the bar and on the street at scamschool.tv, and my little weekly train wreck at the bbliveshow.com. Terrible, terrible show. Nobody should watch it. At bbliveshow.com.
Your first elevator pitch is a lot better than your second. I'm not going to lie.
But my second is a lot more honest.
Gina, you've had the whole show to prepare. What are you pimping?
I am pimping my other Twitch show that I co-host with Jeff Jarvis and Leo when he gets back. This Week in Google, it airs on Saturdays at 2:15 p.m. Pacific time, so you can catch it here. And I'm also disclosing all of my sponsorships at smarterware.org, where I blog when I'm feeling good.
What do you do when you're feeling bad?
I don't blog. I Twitter when I'm feeling bad.
I don't blog.
She accepts gifts in exchange for positive blogs.
And I'm leaving it at that.
I accept gifts and then, you know, compose blog posts with full disclosures.
Patrick Norton, what are you working on? Techzilla as usual. And what else?
Techzilla.com with the fabulous Veronica Belmont. We're the Mickey Mouse Club for geeks, except I didn't say Mickey Mouse because then Disney would sue me. So we're an
Mickey
enthusiast
Mouse.
For technology. Yes.
Colleen's going to bleep that later in the download.
Thank you, Colleen. And by the way, fabulous new haircut, Colleen. And of course, HD Nation with Robert Herron. So we're all HD all the time, whether it's your surround sound, home theater, stereo system, the best new content, weekly Blu-ray releases. We love our home theaters. So
that's why you're so wedded to DVDs right now.
No, I'm wedded actually to something I double checked, right? You know, Netflix has 12 million subscriptions, and there are something like 60, 70, 80 million households with DVD players out there. Yeah. You know what I mean? It wasn't until 2006 that there were more homes with DVD players in them than VCRs. So adoption curve, you guys got to remember, the consumer adoption curve is very, very slow for most of the world, or at least the United States. Anyhow, revision3.com/HDNation.
Nice. I was like, oh, crap, I accidentally reopened a discussion. What was I thinking?
We'll never get out of here, Molly. We're all going to die.
In case you were out there thinking, who is that person and where did she come from? I am an executive editor at CNETTV.com where I host a show called The Buzz Report. It's kind of like the daily show for technology news. And I have a new show called CNET Conversations because every time I'm on, Leo goes, what are you doing that's new? And it makes me feel like a loser. This time I have a new show called CNET Conversations where myself and a colleague from news.com interview a really important person in technology. We've talked to Anish Chopra, the federal CTO, and then our latest interview is Steve Ballmer.
Wow.
Yeah, that one's up right now at
CNET.com/conversations.
And yes, he is scary.
I was about to say, is he physically intimidating?
Yes.
Wow.
We will talk about that in the post show because another twit is in the can.
Round the horn.